Welcome to the Towers Podcast. I'm Kate Tanula, and I am one of the editors-in-chief of this year's magazine. The Tower is the undergraduate art and literary magazine at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. The magazine is produced, published, and promoted all by students during a two-semester course. Every year, the Tower staff chooses a theme for the edition. This year, our theme is Asterisk. We chose Asterisk for its different functions across disciplines. It can be used to reference footnotes, mark a section break, and serve as a symbol for multiplication. Asterisks can be used in many ways, and this fluidity is at the heart of this year's theme. Our theme underscores that there is always more to uncover. We believe that the adaptability of asterisk lends itself to creating an inclusive space that supports the exploration of new and numerous approaches to life and storytelling. My co-editor-in-chief, Lawrence Lee, is going to talk a little bit about why we're listening to a podcast right now instead of hanging out at our annual launch party.
Hi, I'm Lawrence Lee. Usually, we celebrate the publication of our magazine in April with a launch party at the Wiseman Art Museum. Due to the coronavirus pandemic, that party was canceled. With our entire campus shut down, our staff had to get creative to find a way we could celebrate this year's edition. Like the launch party, this podcast will feature both staff and artists. You'll hear contributors read from their writing and others discuss their work, as well as some of our editors talk about their experience being on staff and their personal favorites from this year's edition, all from a combination of this edition's art, fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. To see featured art, please check out our art/artwords page at sites.google.com/umn.edu/thetower2020podcast. The Tower staff would also like to thank our professor and faculty advisor, Dr. Jim Selar. Without Dr. Selar's help, this magazine and podcast wouldn't be possible. Now let's hear a word from our genre chief.
Hi everyone, my name is Mickey. I'm an art editor and marketing director with The Tower. Being a part of this magazine has been an incredible experience, and I thank both everyone that I've worked with and those that have submitted art and writing. One thing that I loved about working in the art genre is the variety of art we receive. Our campus is full of brilliant visual artists, with many people creating art in more than one medium. I was happy to see all the different kinds of photography, paintings, woodcuts, prints, ceramic, and mixed media forms submitted by students this year. Art can take on an endless variety of forms, and I think that art paired with text and writing can provide readers with new perspectives over and over again. As you page through our magazine, you'll be able to see beautiful spreads of this year's art along with some great poems and stories. Thanks for tuning in to our first Tower podcast, and I hope you enjoy. Hi everyone, this is Mickey. I would now like to introduce contributing artist Christian Hastad. Christian is an emerging artist in the Minneapolis area and a senior at the University of Minnesota pursuing his BFA. Christian's artwork explores the relationship between digital processes and the human touch, and how this conjunction can lead to new forms of creating, thinking, and connecting. He has two of his pieces featured in our magazine, Aberration and Born. Aberration is also featured as our amazing cover image for this year's issue. One thing I love about Christian's work is how he uses strong contrast between warm and cool colors to create deep and engaging imagery. These pieces definitely make you want to keep looking back. Let's hear from Christian.
Hello, my name is Christian Hastad. I am a contributor to this year's edition of the Tower Art and Literary Magazine. My contributions are Aberration and Born. Each of these are paintings that are characteristic of my style of creating. Each are the result of an experimental inkjet printing process onto canvas, which starts in the digital realm using photo manipulation software such as Photoshop, and it is then pressed through a printer onto canvas. Afterwards, I juxtapose that digital element with a very traditional oil painting application of material. I felt that it was surprisingly fitting that Aberration would be on the cover of this year's edition. For an aberration, the definition of the word is kind of an unwelcome shift in the scenario of things. And I was first thinking about that in terms of how life as we know it is being wrapped around a digitization process so rapidly. But now, all of a sudden, it's also characteristic of the pandemic scenario that our society is finding itself within. For these reasons, I felt very, very happy and honored to see that Aberration would find its way onto the cover, and this style of painting would find itself in the magazine as well. So, thank you.
Hi, I'm Jess, and I'm a publicist, copy editor, and the chief nonfiction editor for this year's edition of The Tower. Something I love about creative nonfiction is that it allows us to reflect on personal experiences in new and engaging ways. I believe retelling our own stories reveals what's important to us, and it's worthwhile to pay attention to the stories that others choose to share. Reflecting on my own experience over this past year, I'm very grateful to have had a genre committee as supportive and creative as this one. Collaborating with Bailey, Maddie, Swetha, and Lauren has been great, and I honestly can't thank them enough for their hard work. Outside of our genre committee, Bailey was one of our managing editors, always updating us on dates and deadlines. She was a huge reason we were able to keep our magazine production on track. Swetha's role as a development director provided us the funding to create this magazine and host our first ever spring gala, which was a super exciting event for all of us. Maddie was an online editor, providing content for you on social media about our staff and our magazine's progress, fostering our Tower community online. And lastly, Lauren's responsibility as editor-in-chief was a huge one, honing our creative vision for the entire magazine and making it into the finished product we have today. Each one of us brought our own unique strengths and insights to the table, and I believe that's demonstrated in the assortment of amazing nonfiction pieces that we've chosen to publish. It has truly been a pleasure to be chief for this committee, so thank you. I also want to thank our entire staff and every person who submitted to us this year. I loved working with so many of my talented peers and learning from the stories that they found important to tell.
My name is Maddie Folstein, and along with editing our nonfiction genre, I also worked as an online editor for the magazine. Each year, I look forward to reading the nonfiction pieces in The Tower. They always represent a wide range of experiences while elevating the distinct perspective of their authors. This year, as we focused on the asterisk and its ability to draw attention to what is typically confined to the margins, is no exception. It's been a real treat to work with this team of nonfiction editors who brought their unique expertise and interests to all of our conversations. Together, we assembled a nonfiction section that touches on the wide range of the human experience, including memory, art, humor, psychology, food, music, and so much more. Thank you to our nonfiction authors for sharing these stories, and to you, our readers and listeners, for taking the time to hear them.
Hello, everyone. My name is Swetha Sarvanan, and I am a development director, copy editor, and nonfiction editor for The Tower. The following piece that you'll hear, The Left Breast, is by Demetria Sabanti, who is a junior studying English and creative writing. When not habitually reading memoirs and poetry, she enjoys documenting her life through writing, painting, and tweeting. After graduating, she hopes to pursue an MFA in nonfiction in the hopes of one day publishing a memoir. We chose to publish The Left Breast for its use of detail and artistic self-reflection. Please welcome Demetria.
The Left Breast. I paint a portrait of my naked body, catching the reds, yellows, the surprise of purples, the saturated blues, all the unforeseen hues of my skin. In my reference photo, I'm standing in a shower looking regal. My body is turned about 30 degrees to my right, draping my left side in shadow. But my face is pointed straight toward the camera, chin up loud, no smile, no frown. My knee is jutting out with nerve. My hands are delicately curled into fists. My right breast is obscured, but my left is arresting, bulging, a glowing lighthouse, the heart of the photo. I don't look angry. I look undeniable. My brush is bathed in pigment, tacky acrylic calcifying in the brush hairs, stiff, stiff, stiff. I ponder how to capture the attitude of the neck, the grit of the lips, the density of the ass, the caress of the hair, the hate of the retina. I begin with the left breast, the apex of the photograph. The guts of me, the red core, found not in the stomach, the sad sack hanging out, but in my left breast. It holds, in its majesty, my very essence. This breast, imperfect, pointing out like a cone, has never drawn my attention before. It's merely been a swelling, sore reminder that I'm about to bleed. I study the form of my breast, a fatty pomegranate with a bullseye in its center. In the photo, the breast is ignited, divine. I stare at it for so long, with such reverence, that I almost forget it has ever been touched. But it has been touched. I fail to escape the hands, eyes, mouths, both wanted and unwanted, both foreign and beloved, which have reached for my breast. In a crowd, pulsing toward the stage with the force of a great sweaty magnet. In a cold and sterile apartment, so undecorated and blank, like the man who occupies it. In a kitchen crowded like an ant farm. The intruders are endless, daring to linger everywhere, on my mighty left breast, a flag to which they pledge their blind, hungry patriotism. My flesh neglected and consumed. Both bare and clothed, I've felt the map of my body searched and examined. I am nude to the world. My fingers grip my palette knife furiously, stirring the paints into the tints of my skin. My neck aches, as it always does, the thudding pain of defeat, each brushstroke an unforgivable mistake. The rendition's nothing like the real thing. I suppose it is a gift to be so dissatisfied with a rendition of my body. I'm not frustrated at the inaccuracy of the image. I'm angry that the photo is so much more striking, so elegant. I am unable to capture my body's own beauty. I examine the photo, my form, its contours and edges, each inch demanding acknowledgement. I keep getting hung up on my chest, the damn left breast, so pointed and decided. It occurs to me that it looks brave, so proud to announce itself in that way, to demand the honor it has been denied. I lean back and sigh, almost satisfied. The painting is not as striking as the photograph, but the strokes of the chest are looking heroic. My left breast, still soft and dense, tethered to me, a rusted anchor.
Hi, I'm Bailey, a managing editor, copy editor, and nonfiction editor for The Tower. The next piece you'll hear, Asking for a Friend, is by Abby Person, who wrote this while on exchange in Amsterdam. Abby is a psychology student, but for many Christmases and birthdays, she's been given notebooks and fancy pens from family members who know she's always wanted to be a writer. Staff on The Tower chose to include this piece because of its scientific perspective and dry humor. Here's Asking for a Friend.
Asking for a Friend. Perhaps one of the most overlooked and revealing of psychological questionnaires is the two-component models of socially desirable responding. Researchers use this measure when they want to identify participants who will say anything to be liked. The logic behind questionnaires that measure socially desirable bias is that humans universally engage in behaviors that we all deny doing, like taking sick leave when we aren't really sick, or voting for candidates we know little about. And that while the average participant will admit to these behaviors in the context of an anonymous questionnaire, socially desirable responders will be unable to admit to doing these things because they need to be liked and approved. In essence, this measure is trying to identify the people pleasers. The thing is, in writing these questions, researchers are admitting what they do too. So instead of having only a vague image of the creator of this measure as a gray-haired and glasses-wearing professor or an aloof researcher in a lab coat, I now know that they may try to get revenge instead of forgive or doubt their sexual adequacy. And I wonder, if I were to write my own measure of social desirability, what items would I include? It might look something like this. Do you ever steal 2 slices of bread from your roommate when you discover that your own has turned frosty blue with mold and proceed to make yourself feel better about the theft by telling yourself that 5 months ago she ate your Trader Joe's microwavable quiche thinking it was her own and never replaced it, even though she said she would? Do you ever find a way to work in a story about cleaning the sink the other day, including details of the brown sludge that had worked itself into drain and spigots, and the hope that your dirty roommate will get the hint and clean something already? Do you ever conspicuously place your book face up while reading in public so that the people sitting beside you can see that you're reading Fyodor Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, which you will later guiltily put aside? Bored. Do you ever insist to your significant other that it's only fair each of you pay for things equitably in the relationship, even though he has more money, and then become secretly disappointed when he tells the waiter to split the check? Do you ever watch consecutive hours of America's Next Top Model, but when discussing the show with friends, speak as if you're watching the show for some sort of sociological purpose, tossing out words like consumerism and objectification, instead of saying that you watch it because of the drama and destination photo shoots? Do you ever abstain from recycling simply because the trash can is a little closer? Do you subscribe to various news podcasts and email newsletters, knowing that you really should become more politically aware, but move those email newsletters to the trash, unread? And when, on a whim, you open your iPhone's news app, thinking you may as well use a spare minute to catch up, do you swiftly drag your finger past articles pertaining to impeachment processes and trade agreements, and instead open an article about Drew Barrymore's recent weight loss? When sharing a one-room apartment that can only be described as acoustic, with a roommate you're not particularly close to, do you ever leave the apartment simply so that you can take a shit in a more discreet location? Do you feel guilty in museums because while you and your friend are staring at the same artist's description, she seems to be reading it, and you're thinking about whether you'd rather wear your high-waisted green pants or your loose-legged yellow ones the next day? Asking for a friend.
Hi, I'm Lauren Swee, editor-in-chief and nonfiction editor for The Tower. You're about to hear Abe Diaz's return to form. Abe Diaz is studying Asian and Middle Eastern studies. When he isn't struggling to write, you may find him at his kitchen sink scrubbing dish after dirty dish, or petting his dog who really wants to go to the park but can't because Abe is busy. Our nonfiction committee loves Return to Form for its ability to braid together themes of authenticity and identity through two main threads: Abe's experience with Filipino-American cuisine and his passion for Radiohead's 2000 album Kid A. Here's Return to Form.
Return to Form. Alas, 'tis shit. Blank, 2006. The Ordinary World. You press play and the disc whirs. The player's digital time code displays a row of zeros accompanied by a brief but tense silence. Then, the first sound you hear is an arpeggio, five cascading notes from the mellow hum of an electric piano followed by the pulse of a kick drum. Is it a real kit or a machine? You can't quite tell. Meanwhile, the electric keys cycle through a short three-chord progression, C, D-flat minor, then E-flat minor, and back to C. Phrygian, according to Western music theory, therefore enigmatic, haunting even, especially once the unintelligible vocals fade in, scrubbing forward and backward, chanting gibberish. The soundscape is unsettling, but groovy, and you notice your foot is quietly tapping along with a subtle metronomic drive of the bass drum. The garbled chants give way to an unmistakable voice. However, while you recognize the bright timbre of the singer, you cannot decipher the bizarre lyrics, the first verse a repetition of the same line. Yesterday I woke up sucking on lemon. Yesterday I woke up sucking on lemon. You contemplate whether it has value as surrealist poetry or if it is just trivial nonsense. It isn't long before you ask, where are the guitars? I thought this was alt-rock. Give me a power chord, for Christ's sake. You watch the time code accumulate elapsed time, holding your breath as you anticipate a moment of relief at the sound of something more familiar. Your foot continues tapping while you wait and wait, while the track's eponymous refrain insists that everything is in its right place. Nothing about this place seems right to you at all. Departures. A Boy is the only full-service restaurant in the Twin Cities, and to the best of my knowledge, in all of Minnesota that specializes exclusively in Filipino food. The one-year-old restaurant stands on the southeast corner, fittingly, of Nicolette Avenue and West 43rd Street in the Kingfield neighborhood of Minneapolis' South Side. Its neighbor across the street is another small, region-specific eatery, the Southern Soul-inspired Revival. And on the other side of Nicolette is another commercial low-rise with storefronts, a bike shop, a record store, and what appears to be a small clinic. The three of us, my girlfriend Sigrid, my sister Lee, and myself, arrived just before 7 p.m. on a Saturday night. Outside, the late November air was brisk, and it had been dark for hours. As we hurried to cover the block between our car and the restaurant, I noticed myself feeling tense, jittery. I'd been to a poi once before, and it was okay. To be fair, I had unnecessarily high expectations back then. On the one hand, I was still naively holding on to the hope that restaurants could provide a level of excitement worth seeking. And on the other, I was projecting a much greater significance onto the experience, regarding the act of eating at a Filipino restaurant as partaking in some sort of spiritual homecoming, an affirmation of identity. Instead, all that was affirmed was a feeling of incompleteness. I recognized the flavors brought to our table, but something was off. Maybe it was the contrived restaurant quote-unquote atmosphere, or the deliberate presentation with the self-proclaimed foodie eye in mind. In the end, the dishes resembled the food that nourished my upbringing, but it seems that that was not enough. In spite of my disappointment, I found myself back at a poi. Only this time I was determined not to scrutinize this moment for something it was not, what it could never be. I had confidence in my ability to quell my expectations, but was nonetheless feeling anxious about something. Perhaps deep down, some part of me wanted so badly to be proven wrong. I tucked my hands into my coat pockets and immediately dismissed the thought, blaming the jitters on the cold. Hyphenated Rock. 3 years after their breakthrough album OK Computer redefined alt-rock, Radiohead redefined themselves with the release of their highly anticipated fourth studio album, Kid A. The band during this era is commonly portrayed as disillusioned by the oversaturation of prog rock and Britpop, and discouraged by the attempts to imitate OK Computer's success, by which they too felt constrained. The arduous 18-month recording process was so fraught with conflicting ideas and unproductive sessions that the group nearly reached a breaking point, agreeing to disband should their efforts continue in vain. So, Radiohead sought to redefine themselves by undefining themselves. They set aside their guitars, dismantled the traditional band hierarchy, and strived to defamiliarize the listener by increasing the distance in the artist-consumer paradigm. Frontman Thom Yorke obscured his ballady tenor voice behind modulators and esoteric lyrics. Johnny Greenwood, guitarist cum keyboardist cum orchestral arranger cum synth programmer, etc., continued to tinker with the sounds and harmonies one wasn't supposed to use. Filling the absence of snappy guitar riffs was the subdued warmth of synthesizers and ethereal effect layers. Convention was replaced by experimentation. The result? 10 meticulously arranged compositions amounting to 50 minutes of genre-bending tracks. Through Kid A, the listener vicariously explores the realm beyond the tenuous borders that haphazardly define quote-unquote alternative music. The minimalist groove of Kid A's opening track, Everything in Its Right Place, sounds more like experimental jazz than electronic rock. The mystifying soundscape sets the tone for the remaining tracks and establishes the uncanny reality of the album. The title track is a haunting lullaby with York's processed vocals conjuring the image of the Pied Piper. The rats and the children, follow me out of town, come on kids. The national anthem is the first track to feature a discernible traditional rock sound. An overdriven bass strums a sinister riff that, with the energetic drums, indeed sounds anthemic. But once the harsh wails of the brass kicks in, the arrangement rapidly unfurls into a cacophony too chaotic perhaps even for rock. The dust settles by the onset of How to Disappear Completely, which, aside from the lone dissonant pitch droning in the background, is reminiscent of the melancholic ballads from their 1995 release, The Bends. However, any semblance of nostalgia or familiarity is undermined by York's dissociative refrain, "That there, that's not me. I'm not here. This isn't happening." Concentrated in this mantra are Kid A's deconstructive motives, and the track dissolves the music like the road of trials that breaks down Campbell's archetypal hero. Structure is eaten away, the truths of the ordinary world are abandoned, and all that's left behind is essence. Enter Tree Fingers, arrhythmic, atonal. This journey into experimentation has led us here. Far from the realm of four bars, rich harmonies, and exhilarating verses, to sonic limbo. The old world, the band of the past we once knew, or thought we once knew, is all behind us. Departures, 2. When we walked into the restaurant, I was met with a familiar smell that brought me back to a typical moment in my childhood. My parents would often drag my sisters and me out to the suburbs to attend some family friend's party. The smell of the restaurant took me to the unfamiliarity I felt the instant I stepped into the suburban foyer. It conjured the image of shoes piled onto a rug and shoved off to the side. There was often a large staircase that only the host's children and their closest friends would utilize to retreat upstairs and away from the forced mingling. An untouched piano in an adjacent unlived-in living room would prompt the host to ask if I play, and I anxiously anticipate what may or may not happen when I say yes. As I waited in front of the host stand, I considered whether or not the smell was a good sign, resisting the urge to mull over, quote-unquote, authenticity. Then approached a cheery fellow who would be our server. He had long, moppy black hair, which barely parted around his face, further obscured by bold, round black glasses with thick, high-powered lenses. To Lee's credit, he can be most accurately described as Ringo Starr from the Yellow Submarine cartoon. And what he lacked in facial visibility, he made up for in enthusiasm, which, for the entirety of the evening, we would not be able to match. You're living in a fantasy world. Come back. Interlude. Mom left in 1985. She was as old as I am now. Dad left in 92. Carlos Bulosan left on July 1st, 1930. Even though I was born here, I can't count how many times people have asked if I've been back. Departures, 2. Continued. Bright bulbs, which would occasionally flicker throughout the night, hung from the ceiling, many encased in lampshades that resembled wicker or woven bamboo work. Leafy vines draped from floating shelves that were mounted along the walls, and a few ferns and trees and indoor planters added to the tropical greenery. Playing overhead, above the steady buzz of the Saturday night dining crowd, were energetic hits from anthemic 60s classics to synthy new wave. The evening started off with a round of drinks from a boy's signature cocktail menu. Each drink featured rum, some sort of citrus liqueur, and tropical fruit juice, and was given an appropriately kitschy Philippines-related name, like Pacquiao Punch or Manila Sunset. I started with a Manila Sunrise, essentially a gin and tonic, with an extra L and no discernible hint of calamansi, which was ostensibly a key ingredient. The menu seemed to offer the Philippines' culinary greatest hits, with no regional specificity explicitly stated. Unsurprisingly, there was lumpia, pancit, and adobo. In addition to the classics, there were what Soleil Ho would call, quote-unquote, assimilation foods. White fish dredged in San Miguel beer batter before being fried and served with ube chips, adobo chicken wings with honey and a sesame seed garnish, and longanisa in burger form topped with annatto aioli on brioche. There was even the infamous Pinoy spaghetti with its hot dogs and shredded cheddar. As per the cuisine, most of the menu was meat-based, so Sigrid Lee and I would have to put our vegetarianism on hold. We began naturally with pulutan, selecting the lumpia and sisig. There was no shortage of pork that night. The lumpia were long and thin cigarillos, golden brown and cut on a bias, giving one end a distinct point. They had the delicate crunch and light savoriness of the lumpia I had grown so familiar with as a child, staples of every big gathering. Each serving came with 6 rolls lined up on a long rectangular plate lined with a strip of banana leaf. Forgoing the accompanying saucer of banana ketchup, we opted instead for the bottle of spiced vinegar, which claimed its rightful place on each table as proudly as Heinz at an Applebee's. The sharpness of the vinegar helped mellow the richness of the pork for us vegetarians, thus suiting the lumpia, although Lee lamented the absence of sweet chili sauce. Instead of a sleek rectangular plate, the sisig came to the table in, what was supposed to be, a searing hot cast iron skillet, as it would in the Philippines. Nevertheless, the sisig was rich and succulent, the chopped up bits of chicken liver adding darker savoriness to its meaty decadence. As we worked our way through the appetizers, Ringo occasionally graced us with his animated presence and refilled our drinks. For our ulam, main course, more or less, we settled on the Bicol Express, a medley of shrimp and mussels in a pale broth of coconut milk and chili, and their version of adobo, which was comprised of chicken thigh, large cuts of potato, and bay leaf. By 8:30, we had our entrees. It wasn't until then that we were served our first insufficient portion of rice, the modest helping just barely filling the small soup bowl in which it was served. As we took turns dividing the rice into even smaller helpings among the three of us, I imagined a world where quote-unquote Asian restaurants like Apoy would always have rice ready for each table, as European bistros do with bread. A world where I could simply reach toward a giant heap of white jasmine at the center of the table and appropriately structure the rice-to-ulam ratio of my meal without amassing a surcharge. Where a server, who would otherwise have to take lap after tireless lap between our table and the rice cooker in the kitchen, could leave us alone and finally see to other tables. I came back to reality when Sig handed me the bowl, saying I could have the rest, so I tilted it and emptied what was left onto my plate. The Bicol Express, the smooth warmth of the coconut broth, was soothing. The broth had a similar flavor to other ginatan-based dishes, coconut with a subtle peppery zip of garlic and chili. The adobo was less impressive. The chicken was dry and the broth leaned too far in the direction of soy sauce, indicated perhaps by the darkness of its color. I should have known better than to order something with chicken, an irresponsible refrain from vegetarianism for what is inarguably the worst meat. Finally, for dessert, in lieu of the turon which was 86th early in the evening, we ordered the ube halaya and the leche flan. The former was served again on a sleek rectangular plate in three delicate lavender dollops, garnished with slivers of jackfruit and macapuno. The flan was an extra firm, custardy triangle drizzled with a dark brown sauce that claimed to be caramel and tasted like the artificial smell of the air around the Starbucks in your local shopping mall. After a so-so dessert, we stirred the ice at the bottom of our glasses while waiting for the bill to be processed. I ended up paying something like $150. It was much more than the food was worth, but after witnessing the whole spectacle of the restaurant, the mid-century modern furnishings, the elegant plating, the trendy with a hint of exotic decor, I conceded that it wasn't about the food, and it hasn't been for a long time. Return to form. It was this phrase that sent me down the Kid A rabbit hole. I exhausted the album with back-to-back listens while I contemplated the unspoken criticisms beneath return to form, commonly interpreted as praise. I hear it as dog whistle for, finally, a sigh of relief after a protracted, often tense period of expectation for something else. What does that say about the artist, that waiting period? Are they and their artistic endeavors useless? What is form, and what gives one the authority to essentialize certain works over others? Questions of return to form lead to the same dilemma as authenticity in foodie speak. It assumes that the subject in question has a fixed essence, an inherent and quantifiable purity. It narrowly evaluates and fails to contextualize. Its reliance on permanence pigeonholes, compartmentalizes creativity, and punishes experimentation. Essence and authenticity are constructions that serve less to evaluate a subject, but to flaunt the ostensible expertise of the one doing the evaluating. Those who, following the release of Kid A, still await Radiohead's return to form, don't just pigeonhole the band. They seem to be misreading art altogether. The opposite of creativity is stasis. Champurrado, a recipe. You wake up one morning and head straight from the bed to the kitchen. You're eager to make breakfast, not because you're hungry, but because you're exhausted and you like to have something to complement your coffee. You prefer the taste of something sweet for breakfast, thinking it's more palatable first thing in the morning, and is a more suitable flavor to the black coffee that steams away in your mug as you look for something to eat. You're out of your go-to cereal. There's no fruit because the season is so short. Jam on toast won't last you long enough, and a bowl of oatmeal will last too long. You start from scratch and decide to make champurrado. You have time and it's easy. Just four ingredients. Sugar, check. Cacao, check. Boiling water, easy enough. Rice, check, duh. You dissolve the cacao in the boiling water as per the ratios your mother explained, one tableya for every 12 ounces of water. You pour the liquid over the rice that's nearly finished cooking in the other pot, the melted chocolate seeping down through the grains. You spoon in some brown sugar and stir until the rice is an even shade of deep brown. Is it too dark? You can't quite remember what it should look like and use your best guess. After all, what matters most is how it tastes. As you scoop a portion into your bowl, you notice the rice clumping more than expected. You decide to add more liquid to your bowl, only remembering now the final key ingredient, evaporated milk, a splash to taste, to sweeten, to enrich. You go to the fridge knowing you only have almond milk. That'll do. You pour the milk into the bowl and give it an impatient stir. It seems that it smells right, and you take that as a good sign. You take your first bite and hold the flavor in your mouth. It's missing something, but you're not sure what. You try it again, hoping that prolonged exposure will reveal the missing piece. You think it could be either chocolate or sugar and end up adding more of both. You try your champurrado again. It still tastes slightly different than the version in your head. You've gotten used to this discrepancy. It has happened numerous times with adobo, pinakpet, sinigang, apritada, puto, bibinka. But 1,000 plates later, it is nevertheless discouraging. You look down at your champurrado, sitting slightly too dark and clumpy in your bowl. It's fine, you concede. After all, it's rice, sugar, and chocolate, so how bad could it be? You are reminded of the refrain to Kid A's Optimistic as you take a sip of your coffee, the bitterness balancing out the sweet. The best you can is good enough.
Thank you all for listening to the Towers 14th edition launch as a podcast presentation. My name is Anne. I am a managing editor along with Bailey and Afton, who you will hear in just a moment. As you may know by now, the Tower Art and Literary Magazine started in 1952 as a column in the Minnesota Daily. Today we are a class of 19 students running the magazine with the help of an English faculty advisor, Dr. Selar. Every year we ask for student submissions in the fall, then compile a themed magazine in the spring. We are happy to present the 2020 edition of the Art and Literary Magazine. Please visit our website to see the newest edition available online at thetower.umn.edu, which will be released at the end of April 2020. Our physical copies are sure to be available and free to all once campus is reopened.
Thanks for that explanation, Anne. As for everyone else, hi, I'm Bailey, another managing editor, in addition to being a copy editor and nonfiction editor for The Tower. At this time, we would like to sincerely thank the Minnesota Daily, The Wake Magazine, Fuse, or the Fellowship of Undergraduate Students in English, and Radio K for helping us get the word out for submissions every fall and for advertising the launch party each spring. We would also like to extend our appreciation to Chipotle and Blaze Pizza for their fundraising partnerships. We also thank our contributors, families, and friends of the Tower, and our professor and supervisor, Dr. Selar. We sincerely thank the business groups, without whom the creative work of the magazine would not be possible. This includes the copy editors, designers, developmental directors, publicists, marketing directors, managing editors, and our editors-in-chief. Afton will now explain the work these groups did in more detail.
Hello, everyone. My name is Afton, and I'm a managing editor, the chief poetry editor, and an artwords judge here at The Tower. Thank you for listening. Throughout these podcasts, you have heard from each of our incredible team members, all in different genres, including art, artwords, poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. Every person on The Tower plays at least two crucial roles between genre and business categories, and many have three or more. Please listen carefully to each person's introduction and feel free to reach out to us if you'd like to learn more about what working in these roles on The Tower is like. Although I can confidently say one answer across the board will be fun. I'd like to take the time to thank the staff of The Tower for all of their hard work, from producing a literary magazine to creating this podcast. Working on a dedicated team of 20 people has been exhilarating. And I appreciate the time, patience, and effort that went into this year's edition. Our editors-in-chief, Lauren and Kate, have guided the team's thematic vision of this year's magazine from the very beginning. My co-managing editors, Ann and Bailey, have helped me to organize and create this podcast, collaborate with other business teams and genres, and to keep everyone on our production schedule throughout the year. Our online editors, Maddie and Shay, have done some amazing campaigns and blogs on our website and social media. Our marketing directors, Mickey and Annie, have guided our publicists, Riley, Jess, Maggie, and Kimberly, to perform an amazing amount of outreach and partnership with local businesses such as Radio K, The Wake Magazine, Minnesota Daily, Chipotle, Blaze Pizza, and so many more. Our development directors, Swetha and Haley, have worked closely with student unions and activities and the Minnesota Student Association to raise funds and make publication possible. Our design managers, Sarah and Chandra, have led the design team of Jacob, Maddie, Riley, and Claire to visual perfection on everything from flyers to the margins of our magazine, while our copy editors, Bailey, Claire, Haley, Jess, Swetha, and our head copy editor, Maggie, have followed up over and over to make sure everything we produce is nothing short of sheer perfection. Finally, I'd like to thank our director and professor, Dr. Jim Selar, for giving us the opportunity to work on this amazing team, which has been a once-in-a-lifetime experience. This podcast would not be possible without the help of Ryan Hayes, who guided every step from audio recording to editing, and who created our fabulous intro music. You can find him on SoundCloud and Twitter at DJHayesMPLS. I'd also like to extend my thanks to Jamie Young and the Weissman Art Museum, who collaborate in partnership with the Tower, from publicity to hosting our launch party. Despite the party being canceled in the face of COVID-19, Jamie and the Weissman have worked twice as hard and have been nothing but a pleasure. I'd also like to thank our ArtWords guest judges, Michael Curran from the Weissman Art Museum, Professor Douglas Kearney from the University of Minnesota's Department of English, and Sam Van Cook, the founder of Button Poetry. And, of course, the Tower would not be possible without readers, listeners, and contributors like you. Thank you.